are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 12th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Public Policy and African American Studies at Duke University, Sandy Darity, and Professor of Economics, Urban Policy at the Milano School and the New School, Derek Hamilton, on an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. Meanwhile, surprise, Trump reverses on guns. Remember, I'm not afraid of the NRA. You guys are. I want to do like an age thing. I got a whole. And on the eve of an election, Republicans pour money and excuses into Pennsylvania's 18th district. This is a huge, huge race, folks, in terms of what it could do in terms of scaring the Republican Party. Meanwhile, the Qataris claim to have dirt on the UAE and Kushner, but they won't hand it over. Meanwhile, government funding runs out in 2 weeks. We'll do that whole thing again. Elizabeth Warren continues to slam fellow Democrats over the Dodd-Frank repeal. Kim Jong-un wants a peace treaty with Donald Trump. And Vladimir Putin says Jews may have been election interferers. And we say, yeah, no kidding. That's what we get paid for.
Right.
Chris Kobach's voter fraud fever dreams getting shattered in a federal trial. And an update, Betsy DeVos still totally clueless. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday. Another week begins anew. We are here with you. I want to say a full compliment, but Brendan is still on his
sojourn
to find himself. Spiritual journey. He took, last we saw, it was sometime last week, he took probably far too much ayahuasca, took his shoes off, and then just wandered out of the building. And hopefully
so
he'll
be back.
I
want to explore.
That was the last words he said. And say hi to Patrick. That's what he said to me. But everybody else here, Michael, Jamie, Matt, we are all here for the program today. I hope you enjoy. Folks, you've heard the term Windows treatment. It sounds almost clinical, doesn't it? Sounds like you have some type of disease, and so you've got to get it dealt with. Your Windows, like your shingles. I don't know.
Maybe a bit of a stretch, but I got clinical.
But here's the bottom line. Your blinds. You don't think about them unless you move or they break. When they're right, everything in your home looks better. When they're wrong, everything in your home looks bad. But taking the time to pick them out, it's a hassle. You don't know what to do. You're not sure what to... believe me, it's a hassle. But Blinds.com makes it super easy for you. You're not sure what you want or even where to start? With Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. All you got to do is you send them pictures of your house or your apartment. They send back custom recommendations for a professional for what will work with your color scheme, your furniture, your specific rooms. They'll even send you free samples. So you get the sense of how it looks and how it feels. And every order gets free shipping. And this is the best part. If you accidentally mismeasure or you pick the wrong color, if you screw up, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. They've made it super easy for you. There's no excuse to leave those mangled blinds that make your place look like a set from The Wire or from some other place like that has maybe been hit by a tornado.
Mm.
Yeah. For a limited time, I don't know why I said that tornado thing, but I do have an image in my head of like blinds that have been.
Yeah, I know. I know what you're talking about because there's a lot of terrifying TV images like that.
That's right. For a limited time, get up to 20% off everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. Promo code MAJORITY. That's Blinds.com, MAJORITY, for up to 20% off. Faux wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY. Rules and restrictions apply. In a certain sense. Also, I should say this. When it comes to your health, I've said this over and over again. I know I'm a little bit, I'm a little school marmish about this. I'm like this with people I meet, like, you know, just casually. Certainly I like this with my kids and my family. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. And Quip has combined dentistry and design to make a new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of traditional electric brushes. Okay, so here's for years, I tried to use an electric toothbrush. And the reasons why I didn't, one, huge hassle, the things were enormous. They've gotten smaller, but they're still enormous. And they sit on your, and then you've got the plug, and you got to plug them in, you got to charge them, or you got to have them, you know, they're attached to whatever it is. You can't travel with them, so you get out of the habit. The whole point of brushing teeth is to do it on a consistent, regular basis and to do it well. And here's a little secret. The toothpaste, it's not an issue. That's just to make your mouth feel good. The whole thing is the action of the toothbrush. With Quip, guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. It even comes with a mount that sucks right to your mirror. It can be used as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere. Super easy, super slim design. Quip subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. No wonder Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. Find out why for yourself. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip, getquip.com/majority. All right, so Donald Trump, remember last week when he was like, "You're afraid of the NRA, you guys." You guys, not me. I'm not afraid of the NRA. And how
a lot
is
of people
it,
don't want to hear
you
that.
Can get... You can buy, you can get a beer. You can't get a beer, but you can get a gun. Or you can't get a handgun, but you can get these one of these. That's what I would do. I would look at that. Well, so that lasted about 15 minutes because after he got out of that meeting, he met with the NRA and then he learned his lesson. So here he is coming out with these new proposals, which is essentially to create an elite squad of trained professionals in the tens of thousands of schools across the country. Right? I mean, how many schools do we have across the country? I don't know.
Hundreds of thousands, right?
I mean.
Has to be.
But we're going to have an elite squad, and it's all going to be all volunteer, just like in The First 10 from Navarone. I don't know if you saw that movie. Here he is.
We have to have people trained. We have to, you know, you have to have some kind of a budget where it works. When many of the governors happen to, you know, like the idea of trained people within schools. But the press has to get the word out, honestly. For instance, I went through a very detailed, it could be 10%, could be 5%, could be 20%. These are really gun-adept people. Very few people would qualify. On top of being gun-adept, they have to go to school and they have to learn. And, you know, maybe there'll be a bonus given to those people. Maybe there should be, frankly, because they should go on a yearly basis.
Pause it. Can we? I mean, I wish we could just isolate on the hands. Can we get turn and a chop, 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 a little bit like this, 15, 20, chop, chop, chop. And they have real talent for the gun. You find the people who are born to be marksmen, like the born snipers, and cross-reference that chop, chop, chop with those who are in school. You know,
just why can't we use the born identity program for schools? I don't get it.
Just given to those people, maybe there should be, frankly, because they should go on a yearly basis to school. They start with training, and then they have additional training every year. And I think they should get a bonus, but it's a very small amount of money compared to what it would cost. I think it would be very effective. But when the press covered it...
Wait, pause it. Wait, what? What? It's a small amount of money relative to what it would cost? What's he referring to there? The bonus? The bonus is going to be small relative to what it would cost.
Small relative to the entire program's cost.
I see. Okay. So tiny bonus. Tiny bonus for the born marksman.
And we all know
who's
how...
Who's been trained like born.
Yeah, checks in the mail.
Check exactly.
School. No, and then at the end, and then we don't pay any of them, so we save money.
That's the thing. You don't actually pay. You offer a bonus.
You don't get paid unless there's a
shooting. Imply the bonus and say. You say you're getting a bonus. You just don't give it to them. And this is the thing. It's going to take a certain amount of money.
It's sort of
5, 10, 20%. I'm getting super detailed here. I'm saying numbers.
It's sort of like Trump University meets the Born Identity.
Headline was, Trump wants all teachers to have guns. Trump wants teachers to have guns. I don't want teachers to have guns. I want highly trained people that have a natural talent, like hitting a baseball or hitting a golf ball or putting. How come some people always make the four-footer and some people under pressure can't even take their club back? Right? Some people can't take their club back. And... you don't know what it is. Those words are, you know, those words are hard to train for. But you want to have
But those words are hard to train for.
Dude, he's like explaining peak performance. Why are you interrupting?
Those words are hard to train for. They're super hard to train for. Like, look, some people get nervous when they're taking a putt. Some people get nervous when they're facing someone with an AR-15 and a death wish. You just need someone who has the natural ability to deal with it. You have to isolate those people. So what we're going to do is also, I don't know if it's be 10, 15, 20%, or how many, it costs a lot of money. It's going to cost a lot of money.
Remember
we're
going to
isolate those. We're going to find those people through deep-seated psychological profiling of everyone in every school, everywhere.
And then we're not going to pay them.
And then we won't
pay. Because it will be cheap relative to the rest of the program.
It'll be great.
People where... people know they're going to be – the bad guy has to understand that there's a big price to pay when they mess around with our students. You can't just say, oh, we're going to, you know, harden our schools. We're going to blow smoke into the rooms. We're going to do all this stuff that is not going to work.
I just want to make clear, like the smoke in the rooms, that's not going to work, right? Okay, that's your idea then. We're going to do the other thing where we tell potentially suicidal gunman that there's a price to pay. Like you may not.
We're going to be totally clear
totally
to some
clear.
Deranged suicidal 16-year-old with delusions of grandeur and a death wish that there's serious prices to pay.
Here's the thing.
For going on a random school rampage.
We're
where
going
they
to
probably
do psychological profiles of everyone in the school and then everyone outside the school. So that we know how to tell the people outside the school there's going to be a price to pay. Because some people have different types of
prices. That was totally his imaginary friend. Yes. Like the same guy that doesn't go to Paris and he was like, hey, Brick, should we do sleeping gas in the schools? That's your idea, right? Wait, I don't think that's a good idea. That's not going to work. A lot of people said we should do it, but it's not going
to
work.
Let's go back to tell shooters don't do it. Because it's going
to
be bad for
Let's
you.
Go back to, hey, so listen, if you come in, we've got like the Tiger Woods of snipers.
Totally.
So it's not going to work.
Gonna
and then we're not going to pay Tiger Woods.
That's right. How about this? Free vision. Okay. Everybody gets one free viewing of the Born Identity. And we tell them that's who's waiting for you. In the school.
They have to pay for the screening, and we say,
chop, chop,
you
chop.
Fill it up later, and you'll get the money back, but then they won't, and then we have more money for the schools. You like that idea, Ben?
Gosh, I feel safer already, ladies and gentlemen. Much safer. The president's on the case.
Homeschooling's not looking so bad
now,
is it, mothers?
That's right. Folks, U.S. Postal Service, it's an important tool for any business. It reaches every household every day. There is no other entity in this country that will go to every address for a minimal fee. Stamps.com brings you all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll even send you a digital scale, automatically calculating the exact postage. And they help you decide the best class of mail based upon your needs. No need to lease an expensive postage meter. No long-term commitments. I use Stamps.com because, well, frankly, if I can get all my DVDs that I'm mailing out or personal letters or legal letters.
Your little correspondence.
I send Michael a cease and desist letters almost three times a week.
Be real about who had sent cease and desist letters in this office. It'll be all of us to you.
Exactly.
Stop bothering us with sound clips.
And it's the convenience. Right now, you too can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in majority. That's Stamps.com. Enter majority for a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. All links do exist on the website and in the description of our podcast, ladies and gentlemen, for those ads. Don't forget, you can become a member of this program. Help support us at jointhemajorityreport.com. Going to take a quick break when we come back. Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton on an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Apologies, folks. We've had a little bit of technical difficulties. We were hoping to both have Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, who, along with Mark Paul, wrote an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties. So with us today, it's a great pleasure to speak to Sandy Darity. He is the Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy and Professor of African American Studies and Economics at Duke University. Welcome to the program, Sandy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, all right, let's just start with briefly the history of the concept of an economic bill of rights. This was largely introduced, maybe exclusively, by FDR.
That's right. And then was transformed into The Fair Deal by Harry Truman, and then was carried into a variety of programs and projects that were proposed after that, including the Freedom Budget that was developed by Bayard Rustin on behalf of the A. Philip Randolph Institute. So the basic premise is that the Bill of Rights, as currently constituted, provides us with a set of political protections, but there's not a social protection for individuals' economic well-being or families' economic well-being in the United States. And so we should develop a Bill of Rights that would encompass those requirements as well.
When we talk about a Bill of Rights, are we talking about or an economic Bill of Rights? Are we talking about something that necessarily should be or needs to be amended to the Constitution? Or is this something that we can find inherent in principles that already exist in the Constitution?
I'm not sure if we can find it inherent in existing principles in the Constitution, but I'm also not sure if a constitutional amendment is required, as opposed to a major legislative program that would be transformative, that would incorporate the provision of these rights.
Okay, so let's talk about the rights that Roosevelt outlined, and this was in his 1944 State of the Union address. And then we'll talk about the ones that you three would like to add, and we'll go through some of those. So, let's start with the notion of the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. What are the implications of a right to a job?
Well, we view that as an injunction to have a job guarantee for all Americans. So this is the assurance of an opportunity for employment. People could turn to the public sector and they could always find a job if we had the appropriate program in place. So it's the idea here is it's a public option for employment.
I mean, walk us through how that would, how would we actually execute something like that?
Well, if we go back to the period in which Roosevelt had developed his second Bill of Rights or economic Bill of Rights, it's in the aftermath of the most severe phase of American economic downturn, the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, it was the Roosevelt administration that developed and executed two major public sector employment programs to give people who were out of work the opportunity to have employment. If you'll recall, at the trough of the Great Depression, 25% of the U.S. workforce was out of work. So that's one in every four people was unable to find a job who was seeking a job at that time. And so the Roosevelt administration introduced the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps as mechanisms to provide work for large numbers of the folks who were out of work. So I think what Derek, Mark, and I have in mind is to have a program in place that would replicate and extend the types of projects that were embodied in the Works Progress Administration and the CCC in such a way that that it would be a permanent option, a permanent program, and it would be a universal program. So it would be an option that's available to all Americans at all times. But the foundation or the structure or the form that it would take would to some degree replicate what was done in the 1930s.
How many people, if we were one out of every four working age adult was out of work and there was this instrument to put people to work on government project and government jobs. How many people did it actually, what percentage of those who were out of work were actually serviced by these jobs, who ended up with jobs? Because I'm just trying to get a sense of, like, we're obviously...
The magnitude of the program?
Yeah, the magnitude of the program that would be necessary today.
Actually, I'm going to have to see if I can find that, because I don't know it off the top of my head. So let's continue, and I'll see if I can find you the answer to that question.
All right, sure. But theoretically, I mean, it seems to me that the magnitude of that program today, at least in terms of a percentage of the workforce, would be significantly lower, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, universally 4% some odd unemployment, and presumably you would make it available for people who are in jobs that they don't like and maybe are looking for another job, perhaps. But we're nowhere close to what it serviced during the Great Depression.
So here's what, yes, well, of course, because our labor force is considerably larger, but there were 10 million men who were jobless during the Great Depression. And again, you know, that's another issue as well, because we no longer think of our workforce as being predominantly male, nor should we. But out of the 10 million men in the United States who were out of work in 1935, the WPA provided employment for 3 million of them. So approximately one third of the total of men who were out of work in 1935. And it's interesting that the statistic here focuses on men, because I know that there were women who were also employed by the WPA. So that number is an undercount of the total number of persons, but it's also an undercount of the number of people who were jobless, who found work.
And so we would turn, theoretically, we would turn, you know, unemployment offices around the country into offices that that don't just provide unemployment insurance, but would actually place you in a position.
Yes, and in the ideal circumstance, it would place you in a position immediately. So you could go into, we would probably need to call them employment offices now. You could go into the employment office and indicate that you wanted work, and they should have a bank of jobs available and make a placement for you immediately upon your request.
And these bank of jobs would not be necessarily constructed by the federal government. These would be municipalities, counties, states that would have the primary responsibility for, I guess, taking federal funds and distributing them through projects in terms of need and, I imagine, geographic distribution, right? So that there were projects. You sort of cross-reference those two things, right? Need and making sure that every community had at least one or two projects that people could work on.
Yes, and so this would be a fantastic way to address the needs of communities that are economically depressed, to develop public sector employment opportunities in those communities. I think we have in mind a mix between a bank of jobs that's developed based upon local and state perceptions of what work is needed, as well as the federal government's identification of work that's needed. But the federal government would be the funding source, and the federal government would be responsible for monitoring the program and ensuring that it's executed correctly.
Have you contemplated funding for this? I mean, in other words, funding for it. I mean, we tend to be MMT folks around here a little bit, so it's not as much of an issue. I'm curious as to how, to what extent you've addressed.
So I'm an MMT person myself, and so I do chuckle a bit when people always ask, "Well, how are you going to pay for something?" But let me try and give the more sober answer, which is if we put the 15 million people to work who were out of work at the trough of the Great Recession. So this is just illustrative because there may be other people besides those who are currently jobless who would prefer the public sector employment option. But let's just take that as an example. There's severe point of the Great Recession. We had 15 million people out of work. If we were to put them all to work under our federal jobs program at a cost of approximately $50,000 per person, so that would be inclusive of their salary and compensation, expenses to support the administrators of the program, as well as materials and supplies. 15 million people times $50,000 comes to a total bill of about $750 billion. And what's interesting about that figure is that the same point in the Great Recession, our expenditure on anti-poverty programs and unemployment compensation came to a total of about $750 billion. So there would be a net expense because we don't have in mind eliminating all of those support programs, but the amount of expense associated with them would fall significantly. And so the other dimension of this is that the program is what we used to call in macroeconomics an automatic stabilizer. So it would expand during periods of economic downturn, and it would contract during periods that are more prosperous when people have better opportunities for employment in the private sector. But its expansion during periods of downturn would maintain aggregate demand at levels that wouldn't previously have existed. And so so it's possible to view there being a major general economic stimulus effect that's associated with this program as well, which works to the benefit of tax revenues.
So, in other words, in the event that we have some type of financial crisis, in the event that we have some type of a cycle that where the economy begins to go south, this kicks in automatically. As people lose their jobs, they theoretically go downtown to their local employment office. They get back into a job and they continue to spend and function within the economy, and therefore sort of providing almost a floor for how much the economy can dip at any given time.
Right. So it's a floor for how much the economy can dip, but it's also a floor for the compensation that Americans receive for the work that they do. Because if everyone has the public option, and it's a public option at non-poverty wages, with benefits, including health insurance, then the private sector would have to at least match the minimum that's offered through the public sector employment option to be able to attract any workers at all. So you wouldn't need minimum wage laws. What you've done effectively is created a minimum standard of compensation. So there are two ways in which this type of program sets a floor. And I think they're both very, very constructive ways of setting a floor.
I was going to ask you that in the form of what it does to empowering workers across the board. I mean, what are the other sort of like second order benefits or phenomena that you think would come from this? So first, obviously, being that it would create a new floor for compensation that because there would be this competing employer who is willing to provide
right.
more for workers.
Right.
How else do you anticipate maybe that manifesting in terms of worker power?
So one might think that this would improve the leverage, for example, that unions possess in this newer transformed climate. But also it may create an incentive for the private sector to urge the federal government to develop a national health insurance program, because for private employers to hire anyone, they would have to fully finance health insurance of the same caliber of the type of health insurance that's available to elected officials and civil servants in the federal government. And so there may actually be a momentum or a pressure on their part to relieve their expenses by having a national health insurance program. So it's, that's an interesting, you know, speculation on my part. But I think essentially what you do is you alter the leverage that workers collectively have in terms of insisting upon having safe working environments with decent benefits and jobs that have regular and predictable hours and decent pay.
I mean, it gets conceivably too. I mean, you could extrapolate from healthcare to a whole series of policies that if the government's at, you know, providing paid sick leave, if the government is providing some form of daycare for yes. those who, I yes. mean, all of this would put pressure.
And in fact, what we would want to have happen is to have a significant portion of the jobs that are performed under this project to be care work, elder care and child care, which could then be provided less expensively to individuals and families. To do that would give us the opportunity to professionalize those types of jobs under the aegis of public sector provision of child care and elder care. So not only could we potentially reduce the expense, but we could also improve the quality.
All right. So, I mean, and to a certain extent, we've covered some of this in just the conversation about that first job. But as we go through Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights, the second was the right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation. And you've spoken to that in terms of what would be the compensation for these jobs. But the right of every family to a decent home. That is something that we certainly don't seem to accept in this country. And we're seeing, at least in the context of the Trump administration, an assault on public housing policy.
Yes. It's our thinking that the capacity to have a decent home would be improved if we could ensure that no one was exposed to unemployment and no one was exposed to poverty. And we think of the job guarantee as pointing in that direction because it gives us the capacity to ensure that there's no one who wants to work who's not able to find a job. And it also enables us to ensure that every job provides people with a wage that's adequate to provide them with a decent standard of living. So that decent standard of living presumably would include the capacity to rent a home or to rent an apartment or to own a home or own a condominium.
Is there a need for further government intervention in that respect? Because, I mean, if I hear you correctly, the idea would be that we're going to shore up the demand side. But on the supply side, theoretically, it's possible that having more people who can afford to pay on Monday a market rent, by the time we get to Friday, maybe that rent has gone up. I mean, is there are there other provisions in terms of what the government would do to ensure that every family had a decent home?
Yeah. So I think that one of the ways we can think about this is that we would still need to have some form of provision of housing for moderate incomes. But the other thing is we could make use of the public sector employment corps to actually upgrade the 17 million vacant housing units in the United States they could be redesigned and upgraded, and they could be made available for purchase at prices that would be reasonable for individuals with lower incomes, or the lower folks at the lower end of the income distribution. So we could actually use the federal job guarantee as a mechanism for altering the supply of housing in a positive way.
And number four on the Roosevelt, the list of Bill of Rights, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. I want to note that it says the right to adequate medical care as opposed to the right to access, to have access to medical care. Access has become sort of that word that can mean anything to anybody these days. But actually having adequate medical care means that you actually get the medical care, not that you have access to it under certain circumstances. So
you get the service. Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
And so that would include, obviously, some form of universal health care coverage. But what, how do we then ensure that people actually get the care? Because we have a lot of consolidation amongst hospitals now and medical facilities. We have doctors who don't necessarily service all communities. What would the government do at that point to deal, and presuming for a moment that other factors lead to some form of universal Medicare for all, let's say, maybe it's the job guarantee that does that, but what, how do we ensure that there's actually medical care deliverable to all people?
So I guess I've always thought, maybe incorrectly, that it was the dollar sign that was the barrier, not some absolute shortage of available medical services. So you may want to correct me on that, but what we're trying to do is to create a structure in the U.S. economy via the job guarantee that would take the dollar sign out of the capacity of individuals to get medical services.
I guess my concern would be the accessibility of the existence of actual care in certain areas, and maybe in the context of if you have a rural community, I don't know, in West Virginia, and there's enough people who are working there, then maybe facilities become available because there's people who can actually pay for it, or there's a mechanism to pay for it.
And I think, you know, you're pointing, you know, I think that the idea of the kinds of work that could be done under the federal job guarantee is only limited by our imagination. And what you're talking about suggests to me another arena in which it would be possible to put people to work under the federal job guarantee, which is, you know, the possibility of developing clinical services in underserved areas. So, you know, this would require, of course, recruiting physicians, but there's a wide range of staff positions that could be fulfilled by people who might be employed under the federal job guarantee without having undergone the same type of training that physicians, nurses, or PAs undertake. And so, you know, there's another possibility to help establish and staff clinical facilities in areas that are currently lacking in healthcare services.
Roosevelt had the notion also for the sixth right to be the right to a good education, and you fleshed that out as including UPK universally around, I should say, universal pre-K, and we enjoy that here in New York City, and I think it has not received the attention probably that it should in terms of the implications. And we haven't quite seen the educational impact yet, but I mean, I think New Yorkers who have a kid in pre-K certainly know what it means economically. And this also includes some form of, I guess, a free college option at the for higher education. So let's move on to three that you three have added, and we'll be talking about Betsy DeVos a little bit today.
Well, let me say one thing about the education right, though.
Please.
This is a case where I think we do need a constitutional amendment, because there's no constitutionally guaranteed right to quality education. There are some individual states that have that written into their constitution, but it is not a national condition. And I think that that's one that probably does need to be written into the constitution via an amendment.
Well, now, why do you feel that it needs to be, as opposed to the others?
I think that the symbolism, and given the decentralized nature of our public school system, the capacity to have that lever to demand that all local communities provide a sound, high quality education for all young people is essential. I view it not exclusively as symbolic, although the symbolic purpose is valid, but also as leverage.
And we need this in this arena, as opposed to, let's say, I mean, because I guess there's a similar dynamic like with voting on some level, perhaps.
Right.
The absence of a constitutional right to vote makes it much harder to make sure that there is parity in the way that people have access to the ballot across the country.
Right. There's too great a degree of discretion, leading to variation and inequity in the voting process. And I think that the same is true for the provision of public schooling.
And we should say, obviously, you know, it's much harder to make that determination from a schooling standpoint, right? We can assess what's going on in terms of voting rights basically by looking at one piece of paper about what the statutes are that are and what the barriers are within a certain state. When we start talking about community schools, it's very difficult to sort of assess and then apply standards, as opposed to start with a baseline.
Well, I think we've developed a substantial number of metrics, and we have to make sure that we use the most sensible and wise ones. But there's a vast array of metrics available for assessing the quality of schooling, and those metrics are linked to various dimensions of student performance. So we may not want to rely exclusively on the vaunted test scores. Although I'm not so sure that test scores are a problem. It's the question of what is the content of what's being tested. It's not just the test scores in and of themselves that's a problem. So I think we have lots of options for coming up with reasonable criteria for assessing the quality of school.
I don't want to get too hung up on this, but why couldn't we also simply say, as opposed to having to try and cross the threshold of making a constitutional amendment, I'm certainly not against that, but in terms of knowing the limitations of our politics, and maybe this is just as far-fetched, but if we change the funding mechanism of schools and federalize it more, so that it can relieve pressure on schools to get their money from local taxes, from property taxes. Couldn't we tie in those federal funds in the same way that we might, like, I don't know, highway funds in some way, where we say, okay, the federal government is now going to fund public schools, and if you want to be eligible for this money, you have to hit these certain baselines.
Yeah, so that's definitely not an idea that I reject at all. But there is another issue, which is what I call the educational redlining that takes place against Black students, Latino students, and by educational redlining, I mean that within a single school facility, there is segregation in terms of the curriculum and the instruction that students receive. And I think that by changing the funding mechanisms for schools, you don't get at that issue at all. You have to have some commitment to a universal standard of quality of schooling for all kids to be able to have some way of pressuring schools and school systems to make sure that they meet the needs of all students and that they meet the needs of all students in such a way that all of them are exposed to a high quality curriculum. So the altering the funding mechanism, I mean, we have really well-funded schools that still have internal segregation in the sense that I'm describing based upon racialized tracking. And so I think that just would not be sufficient to change the funding mechanism to get at those issues.
Fair enough. All right. So let's move on to the three that you've added, the right to sound banking and financial services. And you and your co-authors of this piece, Mark Paul and Derek Hamilton, endorse postal banking, which is one of our I don't know if there's anybody who's done more interviews on postal banking than I, but it's one of our favorite proposals. Give us an overview of why that's so important.
So the significance of postal banking arises because in an environment in which our banking system is becoming increasingly concentrated. We have larger and larger banks that are providing customer services, and they really don't want customers who have very small deposits or small accounts. So that's one reason for having a restoration of the postal savings system, is that we can meet the needs of customers who are the type who really are not wanted by the private banking system. And we also can protect those smaller depositors from having to resort to the predatory lenders or the predatory, it really is a banking system of sorts, but the predatory banking system. So that's one reason. But there's a more general principle at stake here, which is Derek and I are thinking very, very closely, and we're trying to develop a project exploring this, that the public sector in general should function as a competitor against the private sector to establish minimum standards of quality. And so here's another arena in which the public option plays a very, very important role. If we had a greater array of public banking institutions, then we could ensure that the fees.
Hello? Oh, gosh. We got cut off. Just dropped. Professor?
Yeah.
Hi, sorry.
We got disconnected.
Yes, I'm not sure why, but you were saying we could ensure that the fees... Hello? Just dropped again. Sorry, folks. This is not our day. Professor?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what's going on
either. But you were saying we could ensure
hopefully
that
this will be sustainable.
Yes, we can ensure that the fees.
Yeah, the fees and conditions imposed on customers could be reduced if we had a public option for banking.
And you mentioned that this is a construct, this idea of having a public sector version of some primary, functions in society to elevate the quality of what the private sector offers. Is that, I mean, broadly speaking, is that what's involved with that, I guess, strategy? Is there also a notion that in some instances it will show that the public sector can handle this better and eliminate the need, broadly speaking, for the private market to deal with this? I mean, where does this go? What is the end game with that?
I think the end game is to make sure that individuals who have lower amounts of deposits that they want to make, lower amounts of loans that they want to take out, have a capacity to do so at reasonable and non-usurious rates. And so, that's the premise. We'd want to have the opportunity, the option for people to rely upon public banking services that would not impose the same kinds of penalties on them that the private sector banking options do. Both the big banking options and their particular types of penalties, and the smaller predatory lenders with their types of penalties.
I guess I was asking in more general, because the offering of the job guarantee and the offering of some type of form of, let's say, just calling an extended Medicare, which would force the private sector to either offer that or to lobby for an extended Medicare for everyone, is sort right. of analogous. And I'm wondering, like,
So you're asking how far do we take this in terms of treating the public sector as a competitor with the private sector?
Yes.
That's precisely why we wanted to talk about a very specific set of rights that are economic in character, to cordon off those components of people's everyday existence that are so essential that those are components of people's everyday existence that ought to be protected through federal action.
I see. And so lastly, the right to a meaningful endowment of resources as a birthright. This is to address the wealth, never mind the income disparity, but the wealth disparity that we have in this country, that in many instances is not only a function of government neglect, but in the context, and you guys cite housing as an example, there have been active policies, and Social Security for that matter, there have been active policies through the years that have inhibited minorities, and particularly African Americans, ability to develop wealth, intergenerational wealth. I mean, just speak to that for a bit.
So I'd like to distinguish between two dimensions of wealth inequality. So one dimension, which is addressed by the proposal that we advance here, is general inequality, because if we look at the entire American population, the degree of wealth inequality is staggering. I believe the top 1% of the persons in the wealth distribution own about 40% of the total wealth in the American economy. Independent of considerations like race and ethnicity, the amount of wealth inequality in America is staggering. If we're concerned about racial inequality or ethnic inequality patterns, where, for example, Black Americans have approximately $1 in net worth for every $12 to $13 that are held by white Americans at the median, if we're concerned about that, that requires a somewhat different strategy from the one that we're emphasizing as a universal strategy for all Americans. That would require something race-specific, like a reparations program. But if we're talking about a right for all Americans, then we need a policy similar to what we're calling the baby bonds proposal. And the idea here is, it's not really the provision of a bond, but every newborn infant would receive a trust fund. and it would each child would receive a publicly funded trust fund. And this trust fund would vary in amount depending upon the wealth position of the child's family. So, for example, kids born into the nation's wealthiest families, those families that hold 40% of the nation's wealth, we would give them a token trust fund of $50. But for kids who are born into the nation's families that have the least wealth, at the lowest end of the wealth distribution, we would give them an initial starting trust fund of $50,000 to $60,000. So the premise here is that we would try to make some headway in correcting, in correcting general inequality through this particular economic right. But I want to emphasize that that's somewhat different from having a corrective for intergroup inequality based on race or ethnicity.
And presumably, if you were to establish a universal right, then that would be the building block to deal with that intergroup inequality as well, I would imagine.
Yes, it could provide a basis for that, and could go some way towards improving things indirectly, simply because the levels of wealth for some communities in the United States, for example, Blacks and Latinos, are so low that children born into those families would get the larger endowments, relatively speaking.
And then when would this, when would the trust fund basically you be able to access?
So our premise is, and we're not absolutely wedded to this, but we've been thinking that children should be able to access it when they reach adulthood, legal adulthood, which is 18 years of age. Some people have said that that's premature, that kids are not mature enough, although there's a certain paternalism associated with that attitude.
Right.
But if you wanted to delay it till they were 21, I'm not averse to that. I think that the basic idea is that we're trying to create an environment where there's something akin to Social Security across the life cycle.
Right.
And that the entry point is to provide every young American with an asset that they can utilize to build further wealth and further economic security once they enter young adulthood.
Sandy Darity, the piece in the Prospect, the American Prospect, is an economic bill of rights for the 21st century, which you wrote with Mark Paul and Derek Hamilton. Really appreciate your coming on today. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties, but it's been fascinating, and really appreciate the time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, and then I'm going to take my Skype machine and throw it out the window. I don't know. So annoying. Skype changed their interface.
Maybe we should go back to landlines.
Let's go back to landlines.
My mom's always trying to make me get a landline.
It's not just that it's a landline. Then we need a whole nother machine to get it into the to the mixer. All that. So
let's go full analog.
We will put a link to the Economic Bill of Rights for the 21st century. It's an interesting time where ideas obviously can't be implemented, but this is an important time where because the stakes are low in terms of ideas, people are going to jockey to get their ideas broadly adopted so that when there is a period where there are people who are more amenable to ideas like this, and I don't think that the vast majority of the Democratic Party is going to adopt these positions, but certainly a significant amount of the Democratic Party could. And sometimes that's all it takes. We have seen what has happened in terms of Medicare for All because there is a sense that there is a certain amount of momentum behind it, and those who want to ingratiate themselves to the base of the party and beyond have adopted these policies, presumably. I mean, we'll see what happens when they get into office. But so this is a good time to sort of promote ideas like this. And presumably that's why these three have written that. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920. Of course, we will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. We will play some audio. I think I threw out my sound sheet. No, I didn't. I did not. I was very careful. I had a very limited manifestation of my exasperation, and I was limited in right? I mean, I was pretty good about it. I just took that huge stack of papers and just dropped it.
It's very satisfying, I bet.
It was actually pretty satisfying, and I felt I had more room to look at the Skype and see that it wasn't working. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, tomorrow night, TMBS, you can sign up for that on iTunes or check it out on our YouTube channel. Jamie's Patreon is patreon.com/JamiePeck. Folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. We will see you in the fun half.